Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. A pleasure to see everybody. I hope you're having a beautiful Yontif. And the weather has never been nicer in my lifetime in Toronto. They say since 1951, this has not been this hot in Toronto. So it's been unbelievable. No rain yet, although they say tomorrow a little bit, but at this point, unbelievable. So I hope everybody's having a wonderful Yontif. And I want to thank Dr. Rivka Schwartz for Achron Chaviv, we'll say. So she's the last of the parshiot of the week. Pleasure to welcome her back. Spoken for a number of times, really needs no introduction, but really a leading voice in the Orthodox world. Has been teaching. Now she's assistant principal at SAR and been really teaching for over 20 years and addressing issues that are important in the Orthodox world. She has a PhD in the history of science from Princeton University, and it's a pleasure to welcome her once again to Torah Motion to our Parshat HaShavushi. Ravakasha, Dr. Schwartz.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. As I said in talking to Rabbi Kelman in the beginning, I didn't sign up for this week because it was the most convenient week of the year to do this. I signed up for this week because there's something that I think about every single year on Simchas Torah when we lane Parashat Vezot HaBracha, and I hear the psukim of Levi's bracha that Moshe gave him before, Shevet Levi that Moshe gave them before he died. And it strikes me again every year. And there's something that I'd like to say about it. So I've been sitting with this for many years, and I guess I'm ready to say it. It's not, I don't think, it's not a typical sort of let's understand the meaning of the psukim and a text-based parasha conversation. It's much closer to what I do a lot of the rest of my time, which is what I call sociology of the Orthodox community without a license. But it's something that I've been wanting to talk about, so I'll talk about it, and then Rabbi Kelman can decide if he ever wants me to speak for him again. So I'm sharing my screen now to show you the psukim in the beginning of Vezot HaBracha, the pasuk, really the beginning of Vezot HaBracha that I want to talk about. And that is Moshe before his death. There's the very, very end of, it's the very end of Chumash Devarim. It's the very end of Moshe's life. He gives brachot to all the Shvatim, as Yaakov did before he died, to his sons. Moshe is now giving them to the tribes of Israel. And he gives a bracha to Shevet Levi. And his bracha to Shevet Levi is in recognition of the fact that they did the following thing. He's giving them a long bracha, actually. The bracha of Shevet Levi is one of the two longest brachot that any of the tribes get. It's more effusive and more fulsome than most of the other Shvatim get. And in the context of why he is giving them so much praise and so much blessing, Moshe says this, Ha'omer la'aviv li'imo lo re'itiv, ve'et achav lo hikir, ve'et banav lo yada, ki shamru imratecha ubritcha yinsoru. Who said of his father and his mother, I consider them not, I did not see them. His brother he did not recognize, his children he did not know, because he kept your words and he guarded your covenant. And of course, Rashi famously says, quoting the words of Chazal, what is this talking about? This is talking about that after Chet Ha'egel, after the sin of the golden calf, when Moshe says, Mila Hashem Elai, whoever is going to take God's side, so to speak, come to me. And Shevet Levi gathers to Moshe and proceeds to help in killing the people who have sinned with the golden calf. I mean, everyone has the obvious question. What does it mean? His father and his brother would also have been from Shevet Levi. He didn't sin with the golden calf. And of course, the answer is his father really means his mother's father. His grandfather might have been from another tribe, and his brother means his brother from another father, but the same mother who also might have been from another tribe. So we go through a little bit of relationship gymnastics to account for how they could have had this relationship to him and not themselves been from Shevet Levi. But this strikes me every year because the thing that Levi is being praised for, is being blessed for, the thing that Moshe finds worth lauding in his last moments of life, it's his lack of loyalty to his own family. It's the fact that when push came to shove and the word of God was to kill anybody who had sinned in the golden calf, and these members of the tribe of Levi had close relatives who had sinned with the golden calf. They followed God's word. They kept God's covenant and they killed their relatives who had sinned with the golden calf. I want to set aside for a minute the question of killing people for theological offenses, which I know for us in the 21st century doesn't always sit very easy. I would really like to park that question and set aside that question. And instead, I want us to think about praising somebody for not recognizing their brother, for not knowing their son. I want us to think about loyalty and about disloyalty And the fact that Levi is being praised here for what could easily seem to us to be a really pretty dramatic and remarkable act of disloyalty. I want us to think about whether loyalty is a Jewish value. And I want to invite us to think about these questions through the lenses of two historical events that I have been thinking a lot about now. I am by training an American historian, and I am by profession most of the time a teacher of history. I told you this wasn't exactly going to be a, like going through the Psukim text-based Parsha Shir. Two events that happened around now, around this time of year, whose anniversaries we are commemorating in the next week. And one was the confirmation hearing of Clarence Thomas to the United States Supreme Court in October of 1991. And the other was the exposure of Barry Freundel as a sexual predator in violation of the sanctity of women's mikveh experience in October of 2014. So I want us to look at those two events, occurrences, what happened, how people responded, how certain people in particular responded, as a way of thinking about this question and this issue of loyalty. But I have to start with the to be sure and the acknowledgement that, of course, the Torah recognizes hierarchies of obligation and greater kinds of obligation to people who are closer to us. So, for example, when it comes to the laws of tzedakah, we know that one has an obligation if your own family members are in need of tzedakah, that there's an obligation to give tzedakah, to give financial assistance to your family members first before you use your philanthropic dollars for other people. And more broadly, beyond your family members, there's an obligation to use your philanthropic dollars in your own community to support the needy within your own community before you give them to other people and other places. And so there is very clearly an awareness that there are sort of concentric circles of obligation, and that there are people that you are closer to and that you owe more to because you are closer to them. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks actually talks about this interestingly as being part of Judaism's core contribution to the world. He says one can, you know, when people make these kinds of sweeping claims like the Jews thought this way and the Greeks thought this way, one can maybe quibble with the historical analysis, but I think the point is an interesting point and worth thinking about. The Greeks approach morality from a first principles kind of perspective. Start from the top, articulate a big principle, and then work down from that to how that applies in day-to-day life. And Rabbi Sacks says that Jews work the other way. We start with a family. Jews start off as a family. And as a family, I care for members of my family. I know how I feel about my own members of my family and my concern and my love for them. And then I generalize up from that, inductively from that, to the broader principle of, oh, every human being has a family, has somebody who cares about them, has somebody who loves them. Oh, actually, there are certain levels of obligation that are imposed on me towards every human being, because if I understand how I feel towards members of my own family and would want other people to treat them, I can generalize up from that to how I should treat people and how I expect other people to treat those whom I am close to. And so we can see the value of this, of the ability to actually see those closer connections and use those closer connections to then help us feel for, relate to, connect to, and support in concentric circles going out. I came across not too long ago, it's pretty interesting, and I'm going to share it with you right now, the Sefer HaChinuch, which is, of course, a Sefer that goes through all of the mitzvot and tells us the basic practices involved in each mitzvah and the reason for that. In Mitzvah Lamed Gimel, Mitzvah 33 in Sefer HaChinuch, is the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, the mitzvah of honoring one's parents. And the Sefer HaChinuch says, Mishar Shei, that got cut off a little bit, Mishar Shei Mitzvah Zu, from the roots of this commandment is, Shero'oi lo l'adam, she'akir v'yigmol chesed l'misha asa imo tova. It's fascinating. He doesn't root it in some kind of world historical first principle about parents. He says, they did a lot of good for you. Not least of which was they brought you into the world. And you shouldn't be a boorish person, umitna care v'kafoy tova. You shouldn't be somebody who makes it as though they're strangers. I don't recognize you. I don't know who you are. And kafoy tova is the opposite of lakir tova. It's the opposite of gratitude. It's to be an ingrate. So you should not place those who did so much for you as though they are strangers and be an ingrate and not recognize and value what they did for you. And fascinatingly, the Sefer HaChinuch goes on to say that it is from that, from the act of honoring one's parents in this way and for this reason, that one comes to recognize and appreciate God. that when I start by appreciating the human beings who brought me into this world and sustained me in it and educated me, I can then go on to think about to whom else I owe a debt of gratitude, and I can appreciate God. And so we see there is actually value in those circles of closest in relationships, and the ways in which being in and committed to and connected to those closest in relationships then in a variety of ways helps us appreciate and connect to those who are farther out. And of course, while it might start with family and our immediate obligation to family, we as Jews have a level of disconnection to all Jewish people. And so there's certain obligations we have towards any other Jew. We cannot lend money at interest to any other Jew because there's a level of relationship or connection there which demands of us something which is out of the ordinary and unusual. Normal practice of the world is that you extend someone a loan, you charge them interest. To extend people loans interest-free is a special act of consideration for somebody with whom you have some special relationship. And that is a relationship that we have with all other Jews. So I sometimes talk about myself as practicing the sociology of the American Jewish community without a license. I've never studied sociology. I'm not a sociologist. I know precious little about sociology, but I'm now about to quote a work that the researcher Michelle Shane was with Brandeis University for many years, and she went to go work for the OU, was the first person to introduce me to. And I have been told reliably that it is the most famous and most cited paper in the history of sociology. So I will take that on faith. And that is Mark Ranavetter's 1973 paper, The Strength of Weak Ties. And it's a fascinating paper in which he argues that we think of the strong ties between people who are very closely connected as being really important in understanding networks and understanding all kinds of things about how people interact and relate with each other. But we actually should be thinking about weak ties. The more diffuse connections that you might have in a broader circle, but that actually become really important in sustaining relationships and societies and connections in all kinds of ways. And for us as a Jewish community, that's something that's very real and very real. The strength of weak ties, the connections that we have to all other Jews, that's not a strong tie in the sense that I don't know who you are, I'm not close to you, we're not personal friends, we've never met, but if you need a place to go for Shabbos, I'll invite you to my house for Shabbos, and I know that you'll do the same for me. Our community has organizations and structures and institutions that provide support and take care of one another without necessarily knowing deeply and closely who the people we're helping are. It's not that kind of connection. It's the connection of weak ties, but those ties create for us an enormously sustaining web that holds us up in a way that not all other communities have. And I think that's something that I try to impress upon my students and get them to understand is the ways in which the web of weak ties in our community creates for us, the resources we have to draw upon, the networks that are available to us, everything that does for us in a way that are not available to other communities. And there are many examples of this. I don't think I need to belabor that point. That's not what I want to talk about tonight. But that's to say that I start with all of this to say that I am not dismissing or minimizing the value of connections, neither the close connections of family, nor the broader connections of community and of Jewish people. Those are all things that have meaning and value, meaning that is recognized by halacha in certain ways, and obviously value that all of us experience in our lives. So when I talk about loyalty as not being a Jewish value, which is the claim that I'm about to make, and maybe a little bit intentionally overstating the case to make the point that I want to make, but I'll just frame it that way. The loyalty that I want to argue is not a Jewish value. The lack of loyalty for which Levi is praised, I don't mean that we don't have familial connections or gratitude to our parents or ways in which we contribute to the Jewish community and benefit from its ties. But I mean something else. And to illustrate the loyalty that I think is a problem and the lack of loyalty that I think would be a virtue, I want to tell you one brief story. A rabbi in the broadly speaking centrist modern Orthodox YU affiliated community who sees himself, I think, as reasonably progressive and forward thinking and is seen by many as progressive and forward thinking. I've had conversations with him twice about allegations of rabbinic abuse and sexual abuse. And both times his framing of the conversation, what he was interested in talking about and what he wanted to emphasize was the risk of false accusations and the harm that could do to rabbis. Now, that could be read as loyalty to principles of fairness, to due process. Everybody needs a full hearing before you make any decision about them. But I don't actually think that that's what that's about. I think that's about loyalty to people who are you and who are like you. That's about the settings in which you could see yourself. I am a rabbi, I could be accused. And the settings in which you don't see yourself. I cannot imagine myself as a woman vulnerable to abuse by a rabbi. It's about the institutions that you have come up through and benefited from that you want to maintain and protect. And that's what it sounds like to me, not a loyalty to first principles of due process or making sure everybody gets a fair hearing. The legal scholar and maybe philosopher George Fletcher has a book called Loyalty, which is a long philosophical meditation on loyalty. And in that book, it's funny, I remembered reading the book as an undergrad. And when I went back to look at it for this, it only came out a couple of years before I was in college. So one of my professors must have assigned to me what then was a pretty new book. And I read it when it was fairly new and went back to it in preparation for this. And Fletcher talks about three kinds of loyalty, which make competing pulls on us at different times. One type of loyalty is the loyalty of extremely close family connections, the loyalty of very close personal connections to family or friends. One is the loyalty of community or group that we are part of, the larger, the nation, the religion, the people, the collective. And the third one is loyalty to God, to morality, to ethics, to a sense of what's right. And Fletcher says that there are going to be conflicts between those loyalties and pulls between them. And that it's not, we all know this, we didn't need him to tell us this, that it's not always going to be simple or uncomplicated to resolve. How do I decide in a given situation which of those loyalties dominates, which of those loyalties prevails, which of those loyalties do I have to act in allegiance to and uphold? But again, I want to argue that a lot of the time, what gets cast as acting in a value of loyalty, in fact, is some combination of acting in protection of the interests or the affiliations or the groups that I have benefited from or am a part of or feel connected to, and an inability to consider the perspective, voice, or experience of those who are coming from someplace different, and that it is not, in fact, a virtue of loyalty or protecting something that is important. It is, in fact, a significant failing. And here I want to talk for a few minutes about the Clarence Thomas hearings. For those of you who either didn't live through them or lived through them and have managed to forget them or didn't pay so much attention the first time around or don't live in the United States and don't really care about the American Supreme Court, a brief review. In 1991, President George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, nominates Clarence Thomas, who then was a judge on the Court of Appeals, for a seat on the United States Supreme Court. Tenure on the United States Supreme Court is for life. And so it's really pretty significant who gets confirmed to the United States Supreme Court. Clarence Thomas is an African-American conservative, a combination which is not super easy to find. And George H.W. Bush had been looking for a Black conservative because he was replacing Justice Thurgood Marshall, who was the first African-American justice on the Supreme Court. So he was looking for an African-American justice to replace him, but somebody who would share George H.W. Bush's more conservative political and jurisprudential views. And so he nominates Clarence Thomas. In the course of the nomination process, as Clarence Thomas is being vetted and reviewed, rumors start to bubble up of sexual harassment that he engaged in his professional life, actually as the head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is in charge of, among other things, preventing gender-based harassment in employment. So there is that. And then the question was what the committee would do about it. The committee eventually decided to hear from his first and most prominent accuser, Anita Hill, who then was a professor of law at the University of Oklahoma at Norman. She later was a longtime professor at Brandeis University. And so they decided to listen to hear testimony from Anita Hill. However, the Judiciary Committee in the United States Senate made the decision that it would not hear from any of the other women who similarly came forward to accuse Clarence Thomas. And so the country heard Anita Hill alone against Clarence Thomas alone. So it became a whom do you trust more? And Anita Hill was savaged, and people obviously had great stake in discrediting her. And most of the country did not know that there were at least three other women who had similarly accused Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment. The reason the country didn't know this is because the Democratic senator who was the chair of the Judiciary Committee made the decision that those other women's testimony would not be heard. Democratic senator of the chair of the Judiciary Committee was one Joseph R. Biden from Delaware. It was Joe Biden's decision that no other testimony would be heard other than Anita Hill's, that there would not be a full airing of these charges. They would listen to Anita Hill to kind of Beyonce to check the box and say, we did what we have to do when these charges came forward. And then the nomination was moved to a vote and Clarence Thomas was confirmed by a very narrow margin, but he was confirmed. And one of the things, I was in high school, I remember listening to these hearings on the radio in the kitchen. This is right, 1991. On the radio in the kitchen while getting ready for Shabbos, while cooking for Shabbos, we were listening to this on the radio. It was really not family-friendly listening. I'm not sure why we were listening to this on the radio, but we were. And here's something that was very striking. The men on the Judiciary Committee, it didn't matter. Oh, they were all men, just to be clear. Every single person on the Judiciary Committee was a white man. Republicans, Democrats, it didn't matter. They all didn't understand the conversation here. If somebody said these terrible things to you, why would you keep working for him? Why would you follow him to another job? Why wouldn't you just? And why wouldn't you just? And the men on the Judiciary Committee took this to mean that that probably Anita Hill wasn't credible and probably what she was saying wasn't true. And women all over the country by the thousands and the tens of thousands said, what do you mean? Things just like this happen to me. And of course you don't come forward because the person's your boss and they can torpedo your career and nobody will believe you. And that's just what happened. And that's just the way it is. And that's just what gets done. And Anna Quindlen wrote a column that I would like to share with you right now. Anna Quindlen was a column. I've been quoting this column for 30 plus years now. Anna Quindlen was a columnist for the New York Times. She was the woman on the masthead, on the op-ed page at the time. And she wrote a column called Public and Private. That was the name of our column. And this is what she wrote in October of 1991. Listen to us. You will notice there is no please in that sentence. It is difficult to feel polite watching the white men of the United States Senate and realizing that their first response when confronted with a serious allegation of sexual harassment against a man nominated to the high court was to rush to judgment. It is difficult to feel polite knowing that they were more concerned about how this looked for them, for their party, their procedures, and their political prospects than in discovering what really happened. The gender divide has opened and swallowed politeness like a great hungry whale. And again, I think it's really important to say this was a Republican nominated by a Republican Senate, but the hearings were being conducted by a Republican president, but the hearings were being conducted by a Democratic Senate. This was not a case, in fact, of a partisan divide here about this, as much as it was a vast, as Quindlen is saying, a vast gender divide about which position you can imagine yourself in and who you think is believable and who you trust and to whom you are loyal because you see yourself in them or you could see yourself in that position. Like the rabbi who heard about allegations of rabbinic abuse or sexual harassment, and the only thing he could imagine was himself as a falsely accused rabbi. Despite the fact that we know how rare false accusations are, despite the fact that we have by now enough evidence piled up to the heavens to know that the biggest problem we have is not the problem of false accusations. So what do you do when you are confronted by an organization of which you are part? Or an institution of which you are part, in which something really bad is happening. Something really wrong is being done. So Albert O. Hirschman wrote the very, very famous book that talks about this. The book is called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. And there's a whole lot of his thesis that's contained right in the title. And he says, when you are in an organization in which something or an institution in which something bad is happening and something wrong is being done, you can exit the organization. You can say, never mind. I don't want to be part of this. This is terrible. I'm leaving. He gives us the example there. You know, you have a consumer product and it's a company and you don't like what the company is. I'm going to shop with another company. And the alternative is voice. I'm going to stay within the institution. I'm going to stay within the framework. I'm going to stay within the structure and I'm going to speak up. I'm going to talk about what I think is wrong. I'm going to work from within to change it. And he talks about what determines whether you choose exit or you choose voice. And there are a number of different factors, but crucial to them is the question of loyalty. crucial time is the question of how invested are you in this institution that we're talking about? How much do you care about it? And how high are the costs of leaving? If I decide that I'm going to take my business from Target to Costco, from Costco to Walmart, depending on what I think about a company's business practices, my costs of leaving are not very high. My investment is not very high. I can switch from one company to another. But when it's something that matters much more, and my costs of leaving are much higher, in which I'm much more invested in whatever the institution or organization is, that's when loyalty kicks in. And that, says Hirschman, is when I may choose voice instead of exit. But all too often, what we see is neither. It's neither exit nor is it voice. I'm not leaving, nor am I speaking up. I'm convincing myself for 150,000 reasons why I'm acting in principle. I'm defending the right and the good, when what I'm really doing is I'm protecting people and institutions who should not be protected. Or when I'm protecting myself from sticking my neck out. And I convince myself with all the reasons in the world why that really somehow is serving the right and the good, when in fact that is loyalty to the people that I know and have relationships to and I'm friendly with, or it's loyal to the institutions that have served me well or that I'm a part of, or it's loyalty to my own self-interest and a desire not to stir the pot too much and get into too much trouble. And I think it's worth thinking about who is more likely to fall prey to that and who is less likely to fall prey to that. And before I talk about a Time magazine cover from 2002, I want to talk about a famous midrash about the burial of Yaakov Avinu. So Yaakov Avinu has died and he's being brought back from the land of Egypt to the land of Canaan for burial. He's being accompanied by his sons and they take him to the cave of Machpelah where all the Avot and Imahot are buried, where all the cave of patriarchs in Hebron to be buried. And Esav shows up and Esav says, "What do you mean you're burying him here? I'm the one who gets buried here," right? Which son is the inheritor of the lineage, is the heir to Abraham and Yitzchak, who gets buried in the cave of Machpelah? And Esav just shows up and says, "What do you mean you're putting Yaakov in there? I go in there." And they're having an argument and they're having a fight and they send somebody back, run back to Egypt and show up with the deed and the title. And while they're arguing, the Midrash tells us that Hushim, the son of Dan, is deaf. He can't hear what's going on. He doesn't hear they're getting into a whole legal argument about who holds the title and who holds the deed and who is actually the owner. He's an outsider to that whole situation. He's not in it where they're all hacking legal arguments and this codicil and that sub-clause. And he just sees that Yaakov is not being buried, that it's an act of disrespect to his grandfather Yaakov who passed away, that the disrespect is being perpetrated by Esav, who's refusing to allow the burial. And says the Midrash, he whacks at Esav, knocks his head off, but thereby dispatching the problem. And Yaakov is buried in Ma'arat HaMachpelah, as according to tradition, as Esav said. There's something fascinating here about when you're in it, you can get all convinced for all the reasons why what you're doing is actually loyalty to a value as loyalty. And when you're not as deeply in it, you're like, what the heck is going on here? Which leads me to the Time magazine cover from 2002. Because Time magazine at the end of every year declares person of the year, people of the year. And in 2002, their cover, people of the year, were the whistleblowers. There were three whistleblowers on the cover. One had blown the whistle on failings of the FBI leading up to 9/11. One had blown the whistle on financial fraud at Enron. Both of those cases we remember well. And the third one had blown the whistle on similar shmeidre at WorldCom, which is a bankruptcy that was very big at the time, but I think is probably less well remembered. And what was striking about the three people on the cover of Time magazine, these three whistleblowers, that they were all women. I don't think there's something inherent in having two X chromosomes that makes you more likely to be a whistleblower. I think there's something about, as women probably still are today in the top echelons of the FBI in corporate America, but certainly 30 years ago in the echelons of the FBI in corporate America, were something of outsiders. And being something of outsiders, they were less caught up in the self-serving language and the explanations and the reasonings and the rationales and the justifications about why this was an important thing to do. And we were protecting important values. We were protecting important people. We were protecting important institutions. The fact that they themselves were not totally insiders to, even as, I mean, they worked in the FBI, they worked in around WorldCom, but one has to imagine they were not totally insiders to the culture in those boardrooms and in those places, meant that they were more in a position to blow the whistle. Which leads me to the second October anniversary that I want to talk about and to say things that I don't know why I feel like I need to say them now after sitting on them for 9 years. They've needed to be said for 9 years, but we could start with now. In that horrific October, when somebody who had served as a rabbi for 3 decades at a high-profile shul in Washington was revealed to be a sexual predator of the worst sort. I was then in the position of being a community rebbetzin. The Orthodox community, the women of the Orthodox community, were absolutely shaken to their core by the violation of anybody placing a hidden camera in the mikveh to spy on women in an intensely vulnerable moment in both a physical and an emotional and a spiritual kind of way. And the added violation, this is a rabbi and a powerful rabbi doing it. I mean, it was just to talk for a minute, because there's a way in which that trauma was sort of, we needed to make it go away for the community to work. We needed to go on. And so what that trauma was for the women of the community, I think didn't really sit with that quite as long as we should have. I had women in my community who said, I'm not going back into the mikveh until somebody sweeps the mikveh for bugs, until somebody goes through the mikveh and makes sure there are no hidden cameras or listening devices or what have you in this mikveh. And I know my community wasn't the only one where women felt that way. The enormous sense of violation of vulnerability. And then here's what we found out. We found out that there had been two separate earlier complaints lodged against this individual with the Rabbinical Council of America, the mainstream major umbrella organization for centrist and modern Orthodox rabbis. Two. There had been two earlier rounds of investigations, and let's deal with it quietly. Now, it is true that neither of those two earlier rounds of investigations was explicitly sexual in nature. They were both about abuses of power and inappropriate behavior and conduct unbecoming, maybe even moral turpitude, but they weren't about specifically sexual predation on vulnerable people. And they were handled in a way that I will say as an outsider looked more like you wanted to make the problem go away than like you wanted to deal with things. I will say it was fascinating to me. At the time, I was deeply invested in this, as I think many of us were, in this hire. And I actually looked into it. The RCA had, at the time, a great policy for dealing with sexual harassment and rabbinic violations of appropriate boundaries. They did. They had a great rabbinic violation of sexual boundaries. They had a great policy on the books then that called for an open investigation, having a committee and having women on the committee and not having it just dealt with internally and quietly. But because the accusations against them in the first two rounds were not sexual in nature, that policy was never triggered. And instead, they did exactly that. They had quiet internal investigations that were either staffed by people within his organization, people within his network, or other Orthodox Jewish men in positions of power and responsibility to investigate this. And there was no place and no voice for anyone to say, can we hear what it feels like to be a woman candidate for conversion? And this is the rabbi who wields so much power over your life, and now he's sending you to run errands for him or asking you to set up a joint bank account. I'm like, what the heck? And twice that was handled quietly and made to go away. And what happened in this case was that the president of the shul went to the law enforcement authorities, not to the RCA, not the rabbinic figures, not to the Weber. And the president of the shul was a woman, which, in case you're not familiar with North American Orthodox shul politics, is not an uncomplicated thing to this day in some centrist Orthodox circles. Having a woman as president of the shul, it's a whole conversation and discussion. Some shuls do it, some shuls don't do it. This shul had a woman president, and I don't think it's a coincidence that she went directly to law enforcement rather than creating. I obviously can't pretend to know what would have been done had this gone through the same channels of rabbinic oversight, but it didn't. It went straight to law enforcement. I wrote a letter at the time to the leadership of the RCA, and I quoted Anna Quindlen's column. I said, listen to us. notice there is no please in that sentence. It's very hard to look at the old gray men of the Judiciary Committee sitting there in judgment. And I thought about sharing some of that letter tonight. I decided not to. But what I said in that letter is we can't just make this about gayrus or conversion procedures. We can't just say, well, this is a problem in how candidates for conversion are treated. Let's create supports for candidates for conversion. We have to recognize that there's a systemic problem here. And the systemic problem is about institutions and loyalties and who supports whom and who works for whom and what problems are made to go away and what problems are covered up. Years later, I didn't know it at the time, but years later, I learned about some work done by Dr. Gila Ben-Shamol, who's a psychologist who studies sexual abuse, particularly sexual abuse in religious communities. And she wrote something incredibly powerful that I've been citing and quoting ever since. She said, we think of silence as a passive thing, silence when it comes to sexual assault. The victims didn't speak. Nobody heard. It was just quiet. She said, that's basically never how silence goes. Silence is active and it is created and it is maintained. In many of these cases where people say, why didn't the victim come forward? It turns out when you look into it that victims did come forward. Victims spoke up. And victims were actively silenced by institutions and by people who said, it's not good for the church. It's not good for the synagogue. It's not good for the religion. Our loyalty here has to be to some greater good that, oh, we're so sorry, requires silencing you. Except that I don't think that's a loyalty to a greater good. I think that's using the argument of loyalty to a greater good to suppress, to gussy up what is in fact my loyalty to, again, the people I look like, the people who look like me, the people I'm comfortable with, the institutions I came up through, the institutions I feel comfortable with. And that becomes an argument about moral virtue. For those of you who remember the Spotlight movie about the the sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church in Boston, there's a climactic moment in the movie where a reporter wanting to know how come nobody has reported on this in the past goes back into the newspaper, into the archives of the Boston Globe, and discovers not only did the Globe run a story about this years and years ago, but he was the one who had written the story. It wasn't that nobody knew or nobody heard. It was that there were active acts of suppressing and silencing in order, again, to maintain people, in order to maintain individuals, in order to maintain institutions. And that, at the end, trumped loyalty to truth, to the right, to victims, to the vulnerable. There are too many stories that we could tell like this. There are just way too many stories that we could tell like this. And I don't think we tell them enough. I don't tell them enough because we too are very busy being part of systems, being implicated in systems, being connected to systems, and not wanting to start up, to rock too many boats, to give too much offense, to cause too much trouble, to stick our neck out, all the things that we do not want to do. And so we speak in code and we talk in hidden ways and we don't name people and we don't name institutions and we don't sit. And in that sense, I think we become implicated in and complicit in the silencing and the construction and the maintenance of the silence. And it is important to know that the praise here is not for Shevet Levi that they didn't participate in Chet HaEgel. The praise here for Shevet Levi is that they did not countenance or excuse or cover up for those who did. Too often, I think we are stuck it's so convenient to say the perpetrator is to blame and only the perpetrator. We find ourselves making the same kinds of bad apple arguments that we hear all too often in police departments. And that's very convenient. Obviously, the perpetrators are to blame. Nobody is arguing the perpetrators are not to blame. But what I wrote in that letter to the RCA, what I had hoped for some acknowledgement of, and what we did not get was some awareness that there are systems and structures here, of there are networks and webs of loyalty that are acting in very harmful and destructive ways. And that what is called for in this moment is not simply, oh, I shouldn't be a perpetrator, you shouldn't be a perpetrator, we should identify the perpetrator and punish the perpetrator. What is called for in this moment, in every moment, I think, is the Shevet Levi moment of saying that there is something here more than loyalty to my family members, more than loyalty to my loved ones, more than loyalty to the network that I'm a part of. What is called for here is et echav lo hikir ve et banav lo yada. He did not recognize his brothers and he did not know his children. Kishamru imratecha ubrit chayin soru. Because he guarded your word and kept your covenant. Hirschman says that one of the reasons people don't exit is because of loyalty. In that sense, because the cost of leaving is too high and the value of staying is too great. There are people who have exited over these kinds of things, and I would be the last person in the world to suggest any kind of judgment on them, because I cannot even imagine the suffering, and whatever choices people make in those moments are their choices to make. But for many of us, that's not an option we're interested in. We, in fact, experience that kind of loyalty, the loyalty Hirschman is talking about, that the affiliations are too valuable to us and the cost of leaving is too high, and that's not an option we're interested in. And so what's left to us is to stay and to exercise voice. But to demand of our institutions, of our communities, of our communal and institutional leadership, if not every time and if not every case, because it certainly is a high bar to reach, an aspiration to that Shevet Levi standard, that our ultimate loyalty and our ultimate identification is not to other people and not to our connections to them, close as we might be and much as we might value them, that our ultimate loyalty and our ultimate obligation is to God's word and to the Torah's teaching, to what it demands of us, to attend to the needs of those who are marginalized, disempowered, disadvantaged in our community, in our society. And we do. We get to demand of our leadership that they, if not always and in every way, realize that standard, that they aspire to that standard. That is what Shevet Levi is praised for doing. That is what we should be asking. And we get to say that loyalty, the kind of, no, I know him, he's a good guy. Yeah, I know he made this one mistake, but really he's a good guy, is not a Jewish value, is not a Torah value. And we should be comfortable saying that, recognizing it as such and asking for something more. I'm looking at the comments. I don't see anything that particularly is a question. I'm not sure what questions particularly there might be, but if there are any, I'm happy to entertain them.
I wasn't sure you had finished. I think you left people kind of speechless, you know. So anybody want to? Let me ask it. I mean, listen, I know you said it wouldn't be a regular parish here. Don't worry, we will invite you again to speak. Have you seen any improvement? I mean, I know you mentioned, you know, you spoke to, I don't know exactly when you spoke to this major, you know, centrist rabbi who was concerned about false accusation. But have we learned, our community learned in the last 5 to 10 years?
That's an interesting and tough question. I think that there is probably more of a sense that people can do things that you can't imagine that they could do. And there's less of a sense of a rabbi wouldn't do a thing like that. But I think that when it's somebody I know or it's somebody I feel close to, I think that initial response is still to I think people, well, you have to understand and he and just. And I don't think that people have a response of saying, oh, I didn't know he behaved that way. And now that I know that, where I think we maybe are getting to that point as a community about get refusers. I'm not interested in knowing what a nice guy the get refuser is in other areas of his life. He shouldn't be admitted into shul. But I'm not quite sure that we've gotten to the point that where we need to be with this. Well, certainly, let me say it like this. I'm not sure we've gotten to the point where we need to be on the individual level of once I find out that somebody I know is actually culpable in serious ways. I mean, there was an incident. This goes back a ways, but there was an incident when someone in the New York area Orthodox community was charged with and pleaded guilty to sex offenses involving children. And the sentencing phase, so he's already pleaded guilty. There's no trial on the merits. But in the sentencing phase, they invite various people to write letters attesting to his character and saying what a wonderful person he is, other than this little minor thing about, you know, child sexual abuse material and things like that. And asking for a more lenient sentence for him. And a lot of very prominent people wrote letters for him, including people who professionally work in the area of, child abuse victims and victim advocacy. I can't for the life of me make any sense of that. No, but I know him and I know that was a bad thing, but he's a good guy. And it's not that I think he shouldn't get any prison sentence, but he shouldn't get a longer prison sentence. I'm not super interested in that. And as a community, have we gotten better about that? Not the institutional and the frameworks and the whose voices we have to hear from. You know, if we have, it's certainly not enough. I don't know.
And you said the RCA never responded to you, your letter.
They did respond to me. I got to thank you for writing this letter. But what I said in the letter is this can't just be about gay risk. It can't just be about conversion procedures. It has to be about whose voices you're hearing and who has a seat at the table. And
Yossi, I see your hand is up. You want to ask something?
I was going to ask, aside from, there's a geographic element to this, let's say. There are countries where the religious authorities are in charge of the police and judiciary. And let's move it away from our community to Iran, where that poor girl was killed a year ago. And the mullahs there are in charge of the investigation and the whole thing. So that makes it even worse when you have a powerful segment, you don't have the checks and balances where the imams can do what they want with their morality police and the investigation is done by them.
I'm going to say something that sounds ungentle, but I'm going to be ungentle. When my modern Orthodox students, when I start talking about a challenge in our community and they start talking to me about, yeah, but if everybody in Lakewood learns in Kollel, how are they going to pay? I'm like, what? What does that have to do with us? You're not learning in Kollel. I'm not like, we're not in Lakewood. It's such a deflection to start talking about the problems in Lakewood when I want to talk about what's wrong in our community. The community that I live in, that I am a part of, that I'm a participant in, that I'm educating students in, that I'm raising children in, that for no longer, but for 10 years, I was talking to congregants in, that community has had really, really, really serious and important failings that have negatively affected a lot of people in our community. And that I don't think we have done enough to think about it. And just when I say we is not honest, because I don't mean we. I mean, the people in the position of leadership in the community who could be doing this, we have not done enough to cheshbon and nefesh about an address. And the mullahs in Iran are the mullahs in Iran, and I'm the nebuch on the people in Iran who have to live under the mullahs. But it doesn't make it any better for me that our community is not acting in the way that it needs to act to say that the mullahs in Iran are whatever. I want to talk about the community that I'm a part of. I want to talk about the shul that I'm a member in and that I daven in. I want to talk about the organizations in American Orthodox life that purport to speak for me. That's what I want to talk about. That other communities, societies, religious groups are in some sense worse off, may be true, but that's not.
But what I'm saying though is because we have access to an independent court system. One of your examples said that the woman president used that instead of the rabbinic courts, and that's why there was a positive resolution. So that's something we should be advocating for everywhere.
Okay. I guess I just see there was, I don't know, somebody put in on the chat box, I'm just looking at this now, talking about, okay, the case in Israel, but I guess that's also not our community. I guess you would say the woman in Australia, the that long case that now she's in jail, I think, finally in Australia. But okay, listen, if nobody, anybody has any comments, please feel, but I thank you for that. But I guess what you're saying, if I may, like the Torah is basically praising Levi for being like, you know, when there's abuse, what I'm using that in the more of a general term, we don't care who you are, fathers, mothers, children, brothers, nothing. And that's the great praise of the Torah. That's Moshe's bracha, right? I mean, that's what I understand you're saying, of course.
Moshe is praising Levi for being disloyal, for not saying, well, but he's my family. Right. And of course I stand with family. No, you don't, of course, stand with family. No, you don't.
Right. That's what I'm saying. He couldn't care. There's zero difference if it's your family. When something terrible happens, there should be absolutely no leeway that he's a nice guy in some other area, basically.
I imagine there might be difference. My father's not a serial killer, just to be very clear. I imagine it might be enormously painful if my father were a serial killer and I might still want to visit him in prison. But that is different than on an institutional level advocating that he not be in prison. I might want to visit my father. My father's not a serial killer, just to be perfectly clear. I might want to visit my father in prison if he were a serial killer. That's very different than saying, well, no, but I know him and he's a good guy. He shouldn't be in prison. Nobody killed 11 people. He should be in prison, actually.
But
he did so much good. Yeah, what? No, but you have to understand, as a rabbi in the community, now people were not saying that with Frondell once he was discovered, because what he was discovered for was so horrifying and so blood-curdling and also a federal crime, and there was nothing left to talk about. But in the two previous instances, when he was investigated by various arms, bodies within the official rabbinic establishment, whatever their calculations were, which I, of course, don't have access to because they weren't open or transparent or shared at the time, presumably they weighed his stature and the benefit and what he was doing and the nature and the harms. I know what they didn't do. It's pretty clear what they didn't do. They didn't hear the voices of the less powerful people who were being heard by him and consider them. They had loyalty, but they had loyalty within their group, and they had loyalty to the people they knew, and they had loyalty. And I'm sure they thought they were having loyalty to values and protecting the rabbin and protecting halacha Torah and everything else. And we know how that ended up in the pages of the New York Times. It didn't really end very super well for anybody.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the Levim were outsiders. They had no more property rights than Gerim. And this fits with your suggestion that that you need to be an outsider to make the complaint. Is that right?
I think it is much easier, as I said about the whistleblowers, it is much easier to do this if you're an outsider. But here is the fundamental challenge. We are going to have a system. I used to teach U.S. government and politics. And the title of the textbook I used was called The Irony of Democracy. That's the name of the textbook I used. What's the irony of democracy? The irony of democracy is democracy means rule by the people, but you in fact cannot have rule by the people. We're not going to do a plebiscite of 330 whatever million Americans to decide policy. And so in order for the system to work, you have to have elites. You have to have people who work within the system, who know the system. They're the congressmen, or they're the president, they're the lobbyists, whatever. You need to have elites. And the question of how you maintain a system that nominally pays lip service to the idea of the people and the people ruling, but has elites, but the elites can't get too far from the people, and this, that, the other, that's what the textbook calls the irony of democracy. There are going to be elites. In any organization, you're going to have people who emerge to run it. In the Orthodox community, we have a structure that, first of all, sets certain people up to be the elites from structures within the system. And then we have structures that are part of North American Jewish life that don't necessarily have to emerge from within, right, the rabbinate, and people who have a certain level of halachic authority and answer questions and things like that emerges from within the system. And then the various Orthodox organizations, common organizations, or Jewish common organizations may not sort of be inherent within the Jewish community in some sense, but shape our North American Jewish community. And those organizations are going to exist. And it's not enough to say, I'm like a little tired of saying, well, the people outside, we have to somehow bang on pots and pans to get attention, to get change made. And I'll also tell you, as a person who's willing to bang on pots and pans, that garnished health, right? It didn't really do me all that much good. At a certain point, the people inside have to say, there is a responsibility on us to figure out how this is not just going to revert back to that rabbi saying to me, well, but what about false accusations? Because here's who I could imagine myself as being. Here are the shoes I could imagine myself wearing. Here's what I'm afraid of. So that's what I revert to. And some other question about how we get beyond those kinds of personal individual loyalties to Shamru and Ratachu Brit Chayim Soru. And I think that's a reasonable thing for us to ask that institutions be attentive to and work towards, even if perfection is not attainable for any of us.
Okay. Anybody else? I mean, I don't really see much, you know, institutional dealing with this issue, but you might see more than I would see. Like, I don't know if people, I don't know if people don't like to talk about it, which I guess is why it's so important you did talk about it. So thank you. And, want to wish you Chag Sameach, Modim Simcha. It should be a nice Simcha story on a happier note. And, some food for thought. Tomorrow morning, my shiur will be at 9:15, a half an hour later than usual because of Hoshana Rabbah and everything. So if folks can make it on the Siddur, we'll talk on Simchas Torah, Shmini Atzeret Simchas Torah. That'll be tomorrow, 9:45 a.m. as opposed to 9:15. And then, next week we'll have our regular shiur. I sent out the email already, people, for our fall programming. So, I know a bunch of you registered, but, starting, I guess next week, with Shuli Mishkin, I guess we'll be the first one starting series. You have a whole bunch of new series beginning. So, okay. And thank you very much. Okay. Dr. Press Schwartz, say hi to Atara and Noah if you see them. I you'll probably bump into them in Shul.